So we have about 22 faculty members from, and a few librarians as well, from a bunch of different institutions, primarily liberal arts schools, although not exclusively. We have five faculty and one librarian from Transy, and then the rest are coming from places far and wide, really diverse institutions. So we have faculty from Spelman College, we have faculty from Davidson University, from Haverford, and then we also have three guest speakers who are each taking a day of the Institute to run. So today's speaker is Danielle Nicole DeVos, and Danielle is from Michigan State University and specializes in digital fluency and visual literacy, and this is actually her second workshop here at Transy. Tomorrow we'll have Paul Hanstead, who is transitioning from institutions, so I don't remember exactly where he is, but he's going to be working through design thinking and wicked problems with us tomorrow. And then on Friday, Dr. Meredith Clark, who's at Northeastern University, she's going to be talking to us about human-technology interaction. And we as a leadership team picked those three themes because those are the things as the digital liberal arts that we think are essential for our students to understand, for our faculty to understand, that really inform what the liberal arts thinking can do when it integrates with technology. And so we wanted to really explore each of those three themes in depth. And we figured the best way to do it is to bring in these experts, but also have those experts be part of the group too. So everybody who is presenting is also participating in the other 2 days as a part of the cohort. So it's this really cohesive community of scholars really engaging in depth with these complicated topics.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of complicated, I didn't understand it. I understand so much you're talking about, but it's like, I think I understand fluency.
Mm-hmm.
But the second day, what was that term we used?
Design thinking and wicked problems.
Yeah, wicked problems. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is.
It's a jargony term. So wicked problems are complicated problems that you need to consider multifaceted approaches in order to understand. So like the classical example of a wicked problem is solving climate change. Because there's no one solution to climate change, and every solution that you propose is going to have some disadvantage, right? So like, for example, switching to all electric vehicles, right? Sounds really great because you're not reliant on fossil fuels until you consider the ecological impacts of mining that is necessary for all of the converters, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a wicked problem of where you kind of move to one solution and another problem emerges, and then you move to one solution and another problem emerges. And so it can't be solved easily and needs to involve lots of different communities, lots of different stakeholders, lots of different perspectives in order to really come to some kind of effective change.
So that particular session would talk about how technology can be interwoven into all that?
Yes, and how design thinking. So, I mean, we're taking the idea of design thinking of like, how do you come up with a solution, be it a system or a program or a device? You know, how do you go from the kind of idea to prototype to test to iteration kind of model of solving problems like designers do, which is typically found in technology fields. How do you use that then to apply to wicked problems? So how do you propose one solution and you test it and then you iterate and you build so that you can kind of create new things there? So it's using both of those things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So as far as I'll call it like day-to-day in the classroom, mm-hmm. instruction and the use of technology,
mm-hmm.
how is that being looked at?
It's interesting. So we've really started thinking about things at both the higher level, kind of, you know, what are the ethics and moralities of the things that we're thinking about, but also a lot of the smaller kind of day-to-day, what tools can I use? So this morning we were talking about the idea of digital fluency, and a lot of us kept thinking about, you know, my students today consume a lot of digital text and a lot of different media and a lot of different formats. And so how do I teach them to be critical about what they're reading and seeing and engaging with, right? So how do you know? We actually did an exercise where we were looking at images and deciding if it was actual, edited, or created. So if it was, you know, the photograph as it was untouched, a photograph that was edited using some kind of software or some kind of physical manipulation, or something that was created by AI. And that's an exercise I teach art history. I've done similar things like that, and I will continue to do it because there is some visual literacy skills. Like, it's really easy to tell AI because there are certain features that AI is really bad at. So like hands and feet always look completely mangled. Or we had an image of a cat and the cat had basically two bodies coming off of it. And if you just look surface level, it looks like a cat. But then when you look in at the details, right? So that's the kind of micro level thinking of like, how do I assess and understand these tools and what they're doing in a way that will impact my students on a day to day and that I can translate very easily into a class. Like I teach a visual culture studies class. And so I'm teaching my students, you know, how do you make sense of all of the images you're encountering every single day all around you? So there's very practical things like that. That's very specific, obviously, to an art history class, but similar things could be done in terms of understanding, you know, how data is presented to you in any kind of way, right? Can you make sense of that infographic? Can you make sense of what you're seeing in terms of your data coming back to you? You know, how do you kind of parse that out, and how do you make it make sense to somebody else too? We've been talking a lot about not just consuming, but creating, right? So, you know, what kind of assignments can we have our students do? Can we teach them argumentation through podcasting? Can we teach them, you know, ways to present data through video production or through website design? And those are things that we have been doing here at Transylvania for a long time, and I'm really benefiting from having other faculty from other institutions enhance what we're already doing and also bring in their perspectives and really kind of get us back into the weeds a little bit more to see where we can keep going and innovating.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a lot to get my arms around for a lot of people, probably too, especially someone like me, because I came slow mm-hmm. to, I came slow to a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Slow, I mean, deliberate.
But I was like, okay, I'm not gonna text because I'd rather talk to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Now my wife rightfully says that I'm a major texter now, mm-hmm. but anyway, with that all said, so you know, there's obviously a lot of discussion about technology and I can't even, is it chat box?
Chat GPT,
yeah. Yeah, is that where you can cheat more or less?
Yeah, we'll give you answers,
okay. So how is the best way to avoid that in this day and age in terms of?
Yeah, so what we've started to talk about and what we're thinking about are the ethics of these tools, right? So, you know, if I had a student who put the prompt that I gave them into ChatGPT and just spit out whatever, ChatGPT, like copied and pasted and submitted it to me. Obviously, that's not original work, right? We did a workshop here, though, in, I want to say March, where we brought in two guest speakers, and they had us play with ChatGPT to kind of see how ChatGPT can be used as a composition tool. So it can write an outline for a student, and then the student can build it. It can even write a pretty bad first draft because ChatGPT is not reliable. It doesn't cite any sources. It really just aggregates information that already exists, and some of that information is dated. So it's at least the current iteration is only till 2021. If you use the web-enabled, it has a little bit more information, but it's not sorting through its sources very well. It doesn't really know what it's doing. It's just aggregating information and spitting it out in a way that sounds nice. But that sounds nice is obvious. Like it's very repetitive, it's very surface level. And so a student maybe does that for a first draft and then edits and edits and edits and edits. And eventually it does become something that does have substantive claims that are, you know, backed up with research and has ideas that kind of push forward the things. And so I don't think, you know, there's a big difference between I copied and pasted what ChatGPT told me and I used ChatGPT as a tool to get me to my own original thinking. And I think, you know, with all technology, it's always scary when it's new, right? Like Plato admonished writing as a new technology because it was going to do all of these things to these oral traditions. And no one would say that writing has diminished the capacity of human knowledge. If anything, mostly it's the opposite. You know, I think thinking about these tools and how to use them effectively and critically and not to say it's all or nothing, this has changed everything, or it is completely irrelevant, but to actually see the ways that, you know, these little things do change, right? Texting is a really great example because for so long, and Danielle DeVos was just talking about this, you know, for so long people were lamenting that, you know, young people don't write, right? They don't write letters and they just, you know, they don't do any writing. Well, that's not true. There's a lot of composition that happens in text form, and there's a lot of writing each other. And it's become so commonplace that, you know, you see in films and movies, right? It's become a device in films and movies as a plot point to show, like, chat bubbles and, like, the actual texting that happens between two characters, because this is how we communicate, and we do it through words. And those words have very specific meanings and a grammar all unto themselves, right? And so this is the kind of moment in this kind of institute where we can stop and look critically at the things that we're already using and start to imagine the things that are yet to come and to see what we've already learned from the things that have gradually taken over our lives and gradually shifted things. you know, what's one of the interesting things was we read a paper that was co-authored by 20 people in 1996. And what struck me about this paper, in addition to the salient insights that are still applicable in 2023, was the idea of 20 people trying to write a paper all over the globe in 1996. And I couldn't conceptualize it because if I were to try to write a paper with 20 co-authors all over the globe, I would use Zoom and Google Docs. Or even if we were in the same room, I would use Google Docs with them. Mm-hmm. And in 1996, the computers that I was familiar with could basically hold 5 pages of text. And you would have maybe one or two of those in a room, and you know, trying to write that all together is this labor of handwritten and printed pages and all of this stuff, right? And so the technology, you know, has changed how we do things, and we can kind of look at those progressions and say, in some ways these things are easier. And also in some ways things are different and we've lost some things, right? There is some value to that slowing into that process of handwriting and thinking about, you know, what multiple people said and not being able to change things instantaneously too. So how do we kind of bring back the things from the past that are good? And that's me being a nostalgic historian, but like, how do we bring the things back from the past that are good? And how do we look to the future to see what things weren't working anyway? And what new innovations can we do?
Okay. I guess finally, so are there techniques, I'll call them, or that are discussed in these, what, 3 days?
Mm-hmm.
Is it 3 days? That can be incorporated in like the classroom
mm-hmm.
in the fall?
Yes. So I think a lot of us are starting to think about, you know, how can we take what we are discussing back to our classes? The disciplines represented are really varied. So I'm an art historian. There's a few folks in music, some mathematicians, some computer science, history, writing studies. So I think all of us are approaching this a little bit differently of how do I take this specifically back to my class? But I think all of us are also thinking about, okay, there are some, you know, even small things of like, well, here's a collaborative note-taking tool. What does this look like in my class if I do that here? Or what does it look like for my students to do productive assignments instead of just writing a paper? What would it be like if they created a TikTok video explaining the same phenomenon, but doing it in a way that fits within the medium that they're more familiar with and kind of thinks about the conventions of that genre, right? So I think a lot of us are starting to think about how do we look at what we have been doing, know what our students are using, know what the digital tools that are available, and think about production as a way for our students to understand not just how to consume, and not just how to consume in one genre, but how to produce and how to understand that when things are produced in that genre too. So I think we're all thinking about kind of those things as well, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.